Welcome to Color Country Politics, where we discuss all the important political issues facing Iron County, Utah. Our guests include elected officials and community leaders in or representing Iron County.
This is episode 46, Restitution, Not Retribution.
And welcome back to Color Country Politics. We're glad that you're here. I'm Jenny Hendricks.
I'm Jesse Harris.
And we are thrilled today to have a returning guest.
Second time.
Iron County Attorney Chad Dotson. And he's brought along Shane Klink, who is the Chief Deputy over the Criminal Division. Did I get that all right?
Yeah, that's fine.
Fabulous. Okay, thanks so much for coming.
Thanks for having us.
We're really thrilled to have you here. There's been a lot going on in the attorney's office, so we're really grateful that you had time to come and talk to us.
You bet.
So, to get started, I wanted to get something out of the way, because I've been having a lot of people call me, Facebook me, and message me about the Bryan Head fire. That trial just ended.
We didn't go to trial.
Didn't go to trial.
Except for trial last
week.
Yeah.
Over.
Yeah.
And that's what's kind of making people upset a little
sure.
bit. Could you just talk briefly about what that process is, how you got to where you got, and
yeah.
why that's important?
We'll give a little background first. So the Bryan Head fire, for those who maybe aren't familiar, was a big, enormous forest fire that started in the summer of 2017. It was Mr. Robert Lyman was setting things up, piles on fire in his backyard. Of course, they got away, 40,000 acres, countless dollars in property damage. So I inherited the case when I took over as county attorney in 2019. At that time, the case had been transferred to the 4th District. It changed venue because they believed at that time that he could not get a fair trial here in Iron County. And so we started to begin to go through the process of trial. It was set for trial a couple of times, but then several motions were filed. So we had to argue and respond to those. We got to the point where we were going to have trial last week. And as we got closer, we've been working with the Attorney General's office, who has a civil case.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. Attorney's office also has a civil case. And there are countless other civil cases from insurance companies and private parties. One of the main focuses that we had all along was getting restitution for victims.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought if we can get a criminal conviction, that would be make it that much easier in the civil cases
okay.
to do. But as we negotiated and spoke with the Attorney General's office and these others, we learned that the insurance companies don't have to honor a claim if their client, Mr. Lyman in this case, is convicted of something of intentional or reckless conduct. So negligence, they can cover the claim. If it's intentional or reckless, they don't have to cover the claim.
Wow.
And so when we learned that, then part of our main motivation to convict them of the reckless burning goes out the window, because we don't want to interfere with the ability to recoup costs or
right.
insurance, because that's going to be the biggest pot to pull from.
Sure.
And so our strategy changed, and in speaking with the fire prevention side, our local Mike Melton, Ryan Riddle, and these folks who were involved in the case, we agreed that it would probably be better just to pursue the second count. These are both misdemeanor offenses, mind you.
I think that blows a lot of people away, that
yeah.
all of that damage, all of that financial loss
yeah.
is just a misdemeanor.
Yeah, and we agree. And one of the things that we've discussed, and I think that now that the legislative session is over, I want to sit down with Senator Vickers and Representative Shipp and try to make some tweaks. Because
okay.
I think that one, reckless burning is probably not a great charge, because if you're can interfere with insurance payouts. A lot of times when we charge this, it's a smaller amount.
Right.
So we can get criminal restitution in that case. When we're dealing with such vast amounts of property damage and millions of dollars, the criminal case is really not a good vehicle to get criminal restitution.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But if we can make some tweaks, get away from reckless standard and make it a negligent burning, and then tie the property damage similar to a theft statute or
mm-hmm.
a property damage statute. In those scenarios, if you have $1,500 or less, you have misdemeanor.
Mm-hmm.
If you exceed $2,500, you have a third degree felony. If you're over $5,000 in damage, you have a second degree felony. I would like to see a code that mirrors a negligent standard and has it tied to the level of the offense to the property damage.
Okay.
Then we'd have something to work with. I think when we're prosecuting misdemeanors in this scenario where prison's not even on the table.
Wow.
Criminal restitution is most likely not going to happen in the amount that we're dealing with here.
Right.
Because the elements that we have to prove, even in the reckless case, reckless charge, is just showing that property damage was done and that it exceeded $1,500. So we can do that in a couple of hours in the fact pattern here.
Right.
So we're really not going to be proving a case. It's weeks and weeks of this fire. And that's one thing I think some people didn't understand as well. So then, of course, we adjust strategy when we learn that a reckless conviction would interfere with insurance.
Okay.
With the second charge, which always was there, was failure to notify or obtain a burn permit. The case is much easier to resolve because he didn't have a permit. He admitted he didn't have a permit and resolved that point.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I appreciate you sharing that information. I didn't know any of that.
Yeah.
So kind of given the constraints that you were operating in the current law, that might have been the best solution to get everybody made whole through the insurance.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And really what we're dealing with is balancing, you know, that interest of, you know, having that insurance money available to victims and the state, even though it's probably still not a drop in the bucket, but having that money available versus the difference between a Class A misdemeanor and a Class B misdemeanor, which in the grand scheme of things is going to be negligible.
Right.
So when we realized that there was that obstacle with the insurance, it wasn't really even a difficult decision at that point.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you taking a minute to talk about that, because I don't think that information was really out there. So
there was other information. I think people thought that people had died during this fire. That's not the case. Of course, you know, there might have been other charges that may have come if that were the case.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's important to know that the decision that I made was really trying to maximize restitution and making people whole where possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't want to interfere with that, and that's why the decisions were made.
Okay. Well, love it or hate it, the decision has been made. So
yeah.
I'll give everybody your number. So
And I'm happy to answer questions if people have thoughts or concerns. And I've reached out to people who I've seen had made comments, and usually people are really good about understanding.
Okay. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's move on to some other stuff that's happening in your office. I know one of the things that you wanted to talk about, and this is something that we've talked about on the podcast before, is mental health services in Iron County. So your office has been working on that. What's happening there?
Yeah, one of the things that we're excited about and happy that it's happening is that we're being able to expand our mental health court. We've always had a mental health court for the last several years, but because of different stakeholders who are involved, you can only serve so many people because it's impacting the agency who supervises them on probation, Southwest Behavioral Health, who gives treatment. So that was always a factor. We kept it to about 15 individuals,
mm-hmm.
was max capacity for the mental health court. We've now been able to double that when working with the court. Adult Probation and Parole has now taken over the supervision of the mental health court. And of course, Southwest Behavioral Health has agreed to take on a bigger role, which is everybody come together. I think it's a good thing because we do have a lot of people in need of those services.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a real issue. So tell us just a little bit, what is mental health court? Why is it important that that's an asset in this community?
Shane's actually our the mental health court prosecutor. Do you want to?
Yeah, sure. So mental health court, typically, you know, it'll start, they're coming through the system like anybody else would, so they have an initial appearance. You know, the attorneys talk, and it's usually then that, say, a defense attorney brings up, you know, this might be a concern, this might have been something that precipitated an underlying offense, and we should consider them as a candidate for mental health court, and we'll get them on the screening calendar. And then the stakeholders that Chad just talked about, we get together and we talk about who would benefit most from the resources that we have available to us. A lot of times we'll have someone from Southwest, typically it's Mr. Jarvis, he'll do a screening and assessment to determine what type of mental health issues somebody's dealing with, and he does a fantastic job. And ultimately we decide, you know, who would be the best candidate or candidates to fill the slots that we have open. a lot of times as prosecutors, our what we look at in terms of the appropriate candidates for the program is we try to ask questions like, was the underlying offense something that but for mental illness would not have happened? And so we have certain criteria that we're looking at. And then once they get in, they have a lot of resources available to them. There's a lot of structure that's required that a lot of times they're required to, take the medications that they're on as prescribed. And for me personally, it's been a really great experience.
Cool.
Just seeing a lot of these individuals just improve vastly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even just kind of seeing their demeanor, their mind frame, their state of mind from when the charges are initially filed to later on in the process. There's a lot of growth. There's a lot of stability that comes, and we've seen some real success stories. And so it's exciting. It's
That's
exciting
great.
To have
yeah.
expanded resources and expanded slots for people to take advantage of that.
No, I think that's a really, really big deal. So in the mental health court process, someone is evaluated and then they're sort of assigned maybe from adult parole and probation, a caseworker or something
yeah,
like that,
exactly.
sort of responsible for that person, making sure they're getting their meds, making sure they're going through the system appropriately.
And so previously that job was primarily done by Cedar City Police Department. It was Clint Pollock who was the resource officer on that. And he did a great job, but for the amount of participants and also the fact that he had a lot of other tasks that were already on his plate,
yeah.
They decided to go in a different direction just recently, and APMP has been great
okay.
To offer some of their resources to help field some of this tracking. And so that's been the major shift is
that's
adult probation and parole has taken over largely the responsibility from Cedar City Police Department.
That's fabulous. How is it funded?
So JRI does provide some
okay.
funds for treatment, and then of course the court is putting money out for different services, but Southwest Behavioral Health is a big partner.
Okay.
And
they're a big factor.
There is fees associated with participating, and that's the same with drug court as well.
Okay.
If you're participating, you do pay fees towards it, but a lot of those things are, funded by the state.
Okay. So, do you find that the rate of recidivism is down when people are able to go through this process with mental health court? You don't see them again?
I would have to take a closer look at the numbers, just kind of from the time that I've been in there, the individuals that have graduated since I've been there, many of them continue to be successful. There have been a couple that that have regressed a little bit. Some people, they really need that structure, and when that's gone.
Yeah.
And that's actually prompting some changes in terms of keeping some level of structure, continuing past what it did previously before one graduates, and so there's adjustments and fine tuning that's going on, but by and large it's been a really fulfilling experience.
That's great. No, I think that's something that we needed so desperately in this area, is that link between the criminal and the mental health.
Right. We have a lot of people that are coming into the criminal justice system, and they wouldn't have but for this episode that they were struggling with, and punishing them or putting them in the system is not going to...
It doesn't help. It doesn't fix the underlying issue. So that's right. And you say you doubled the capacity.
Doubled the capacity.
That's amazing.
So where we can divert those people into this program, I think it's a win.
That's great.
Yeah. I'd love to see those kind of rehabilitative efforts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's good. And nationally, the numbers are still... the recidivism numbers, drug courts, mental health courts, they're still not as high as we want them. But I think that, on a small level, we're going to be able to track these things in our office soon. We have some new prosecutor software that we're going to be starting to dive into the numbers. But also, like you can't measure the impact that it has on even a few lives that we've
right.
been pointing with. And it's
it's a good experience.
That's right. Okay,
and just the staff members, I would just say, and I don't want to name off the names because I don't know if I'll forget this one person, but you know, staff from Behavior or Southwest have just been phenomenal. And they clearly care deeply about what they do, and they just do a fantastic job.
That's great. No, it's so important to recognize how many amazing people we have in this community who are so invested in the other members of the community. And you're right, they just do amazing things, and with everything they've got, they put it all into it. So that actually is a good segue to talk about the next thing on my list, which is forensic interviews and your partnership with the Children's Justice Center.
Yeah, this is something that we're also excited about. It's something that the county attorney's office used to be involved in. Troy Little, who's now a judge, mm-hmm. He and Mike Blake were involved in doing their own training. So
wow.
Forensic interview is it's a very important tool with interviewing children, because mm-hmm. they found that children respond differently to questions.
Yeah.
So it's important to have these techniques that allow children to narrate, to tell their story. Because if you're asking them, you know, closed-ended questions, we're not going to get the truth or the real
right.
story. Because
yeah.
a lot of times they may just answer yes, they may just answer no.
Mm-hmm.
So forensic interviewing is a huge tool, and it allows us to prosecute these cases, or important cases, child victims, successfully. So Shane is one of the trainers now. Mike Blake is a commissioner. He's also
mm-hmm.
training.
Okay.
Mike Edwards from my office is also trained. So the idea behind it is that we can, rather than having to rely on infrequent trainings up north and sending people out of our community and
mm-hmm.
our departments. So a lot of these departments of law enforcement are smaller, so it's hard to send guys
right.
away
yeah.
all the time. So if we can do it on our own and follow the guidelines, we do work with the Attorney General's office. So we have best practices. So we're training our own law enforcement partners here, and being able to share with others as well.
Okay.
In addition to people who are doing the interviews, I think it's just principles and forensic interview techniques are great across the board.
Yeah.
Just interviewing and talking in general.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that we're excited to get back and running. And also what we're implementing is peer reviews. So I think this is probably as important or more, is that we want to get together at least quarterly and review the work that's being done. So
mm-hmm.
if an investigator's done an interview, we can sit down together, go through the best practices and the guidelines, and see how we're doing these.
Okay.
And we still just fine-tuning our skills, because, like I said, these cases are very important, and being able to do these effectively and sharpen our tools.
Yeah.
Is
what's the link with the Children's Justice Center? Why is that an important facility?
So the Children's Justice Center is where these interviews take place. And Children's Justice Center is amazing. The
yeah.
staff there, Stephanie Furnable and her team,
mm-hmm.
do great work. And so it's a soft environment for a child to feel safe. It looks, you know, like a home.
Right.
And so when we go in there, they can record interviews, and we can sit down and we can conduct these interviews in such a way that they feel comfortable. And that's a lot of times where we meet. We have our multidisciplinary team meetings where we discuss cases, but this is just another layer that had kind of fallen off the wayside when
mm-hmm.
people retire and go away.
Sure.
And so everybody believes it's really important to get back and knowing we're happy to work.
So you've got one place at the Children's Justice Center where someone who has been trained to interview children, and anybody who has ever had a child knows that they just think differently. You know,
yeah.
their experience is different, and so I think it's really important to recognize these techniques have to be different in order to get that story
yeah.
from that child. And you record it, so the child only has to go through that one time.
One time. Yeah, because if they're under the age of 14, you can use that in court,
okay.
which has been an exception in the Confrontation Clause in the Constitution. So it is. It's you don't want them to have to relive this thing
right.
multiple times. And so they're really important.
That's great. I'm glad that that's coming back. I'm glad that we get to do that locally.
Yeah.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, Mike Edwards and I are kind of running to catch up. We're kind of fresh at this. So we're grateful to work with Mike Blake and Tom Bird. Both of them have some experience already in doing FIT training, and they're both great to work with. And it is. It's the FIT principles are intuitive and logical when you learn about them, but they're not something that we do a lot in normal everyday conversation mm-hmm. and speech. And so
right.
in order to build those habits and to keep your questions and your responses appropriate, it does take a lot of practice. It takes a lot of, like Chad said, peer review
mm-hmm.
is extremely important. And so we're excited to ramp that up again and work together to make sure that everyone that's doing these interviews at the CJC are being reviewed and improving on the technique.
That's great. I know the statistics that come out of the CJC when I first started learning about it just absolutely blew my mind with the number of cases that are right here in Iron County that involve children.
Yeah.
Devastating.
It is. It's tragic. But we find that, like, even we use them on our own kids, these techniques, talking. I said, how was school today? And, good. Well, good. Tell me all about good. Well, tell me more about that. You know, try to get more open-ended questions because so there's a lot of things that are helpful. I know that we laugh about it, but it's good stuff.
Yeah, it works.
That's it. I wasn't going to do this because I didn't want to embarrass these guys, but I got to tell you, we had this thing, talking about being parents, we had this thing scheduled before, and Chad's youngest, his little baby, he called me and he said, I can't do this podcast today. The baby's sick. And Chad ran home to get the baby. And I just want to shout out, because we talk about so much devastation that happens in this county. We talk about so many things that are just so hard and so heavy. I want to give a shout out to all of the good men. And I'm sitting here with three of them, and they're good dads, and they're fabulous. So anyway, I wasn't going to bring that up, but you led me right into it. So, okay, so now we're going to get back into talking about the Iron County Attorney's Office. So one of the things, speaking of really, really super tough things that happened, is you recently finished up a trial that involved a toddler, and I can barely speak about it
mm-hmm.
without getting emotional. I can't even wrap my brain around
it's just horrific.
The tragedy that this little boy experienced. It's unspeakable.
Yeah.
But you guys were there, and you took this thing to trial, and it was in the news. So I wanted to give you guys kind of an opportunity just to take our audience through that and what it was and how you dealt with it and I mean, how do you deal with something like that?
Yeah, no, I mean, these are the toughest cases that you can prosecute: child murders, child homicides, child sex abuse cases, and this falls into that category. This is a case in 2018. Christopher Leader Jr., he was 2 years old. He came from the state of Washington to spend some time with his mother. He'd kind of be going back and forth from Washington to Utah. And mom had a new boyfriend, and so he's literally in mom and boyfriend's life for about 5 to 6 weeks. And during that time, he's the victim of just terrific, horrific abuse. And ultimately, when he was alone with the boyfriend, he was beaten to death. Okay. One force trauma to his stomach caused internal bleeding and bruises and just horrific amounts of abuse over his entire body. So, of course, the investigation team, this was a Cedar City Police Department case. They come and they investigate, and they did a fantastic job. Matt Topham, Detective Lieutenant David Evans now, kind of drove the bus, but so many people were involved
mm-hmm.
in touching this case and did a great job. Originally, they get to the scene, and boyfriend is telling this narrative that a couple of days prior, that Christopher had been in a four-wheeler accident, and that the four-wheeler accident was the cause of all the bruises on his body. Red flags
mm-hmm.
started popping up
mm-hmm.
almost immediately because, one, the injuries aren't matching up.
Right.
You don't suspect to see road rash, cuts, things like that. That's not the victim at this time. Other things, there's inconsistent stories, and we start asking mom about the same thing. She's telling literally night and day differences. She's saying, we went up during the day, we did this, and boyfriend's saying, we went up in the night and did this. And so, of course, this had to be investigated.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of issues. They get warrants, they get into cell phones, and then we start learning
mm-hmm.
why. We start seeing a history of abuse and these excuses and things that are being used to cover up bruises that have been appearing on Christopher over a period of weeks. And then, of course, we get into the very moments when, before this phone call is made, that he's not breathing, and one of the text messages was, is it Chris isn't breathing? And then 1 minute goes by, and he texts Mom, who's at work at Lynn's, and doing the grave shift. And he says, if anybody asks about the bruises, tell them it was a four-wheel accident.
Oh, man.
So that whole story is blown under the water.
Right.
You know it. And then, of course, we get a warrant. We charge him with murder.
Mm-hmm.
We get to the trial. It was a week-long trial. Shane was, you know, fantastic during the trial. He and I were on the trial team. And it's one of these cases that so difficult to prosecute, not only just because of the weight of what you're dealing with, but just as dads and parents. I mean, there was times we ourselves cried. And,
I can't believe that.
Investigators, we just, it's just, it's a heavy thing, but this is why we want to be prosecutors. This is why we do it. You know, we show up, and these are the cases that we want to take all the way, and we want to get justice for, so... I felt it that privilege to be able to be a voice for Christopher.
Right. Yeah. And you were deeply involved in that. What are your thoughts and emotions and going through that process?
I was telling Chad just prior that it's difficult to even know what to say because, it's not about Chad and I, right? I mean, this little boy lost his life, and there's victims that are going to be affected for the rest of their lives. But it was extremely difficult. For weeks leading up to the trial, we were preparing and preparing as solidly as we prepared for anything probably in our lives. We hoped that was apparent. But we took this extremely seriously. We wanted to take this extremely seriously for all the victims involved. And that was important to us. But dealing with that subject matter 4 weeks was extremely heavy and difficult to deal with. But at the same time, it was extremely satisfying and fulfilling to feel like you played some part in obtaining a degree of justice against the perpetrator, and we're both very grateful for the jurors. That's an extremely difficult position to be in, to be thrown into that. These are just regular, lay people that are just citizens of our community that had no idea what they were getting into.
Right.
It was shocking to our system being in the positions that we're in. Imagine walking off the street. You don't know if you're going to hear a case about,
theft from Walmart,
right? Versus this, and so they did an amazing job. They were extremely attentive, and they got the right outcome, right decision.
And he was convicted.
Convicted
of murder.
Yeah, the jury was only out about an hour and a half.
Wow,
it was less than 2 hours, and generally these types of things could go. I've had DUI trials that went like 5-6 hours.
Oh, wow.
So I think that it's a testament to the investigation that was done, the evidence that we had, and of course the jury just getting it right.
And Chad's already mentioned it, but the officers involved just really, this was something that was clearly extremely important to them, they were extremely thorough, and they. Really took it extremely seriously, and it was apparent.
In my office, did a lot to share the load because weeks prior to the trial even going forward, we said, divert anything that Shannon and I have, cover it for us because we are diving into this.
Okay.
And they were great to step up, and of course, our assistants who have to be aware and view some of these photographs and sounds too. It's tough for them too, but hats off to the CCPD and Chief Adams who allowed Detective Topham to be attached to our office like a week prior.
Wow.
He came, he was there, morning to night. We were doing a lot with him, but it was really
also Jessica Kramer, just tremendous, the job that she does in working with the victims. That is not an easy task.
Mm-hmm.
She is talking to them when they're going through something unimaginable.
Right.
And she does so in striking a balance between empathy and professionalism, and she does it gracefully. She does so much work in the background, coordinating and
okay.
And so we're really grateful for her as well.
And that's a fairly new position, that victim advocate at CCPD.
So Jessica Kramer is in our office.
Okay.
And she's been there for, I think, around 10 years. So.
Okay.
Yeah, that's sort of off the grant position, but it's been about 8 years, I think, that she's been full-time.
Okay, fantastic.
In our office.
So that's huge.
She's amazing.
Good, okay.
But yeah, that was an important case for the office and the county.
And also a shout-out to the jail.
Oh, the jail, too, yeah. A lot of good evidence. We had recorded phone calls that happened at the jail. And other things that we learned about the defendant. I don't even like to say his name.
Yeah, no, we don't need to give him any attention.
Yeah, so they were really good when we go there. They would get us the information that we need right away. Of course, transporting and everything
mm-hmm.
that goes along with that. They were super helpful. And we were always grateful.
That's great. No, we've got some just amazing, amazing members of this community.
Yeah.
It's just incredible. Well, let me use that kind of as a segue to talk about what are some trends? What's going on in Iron County? What are some things that this community should be aware of that you're seeing in your office?
Well, we're seeing feels like a lot more domestic violence
mm.
cases. And we've got this new software that I mentioned, and so we're going to be diving into the data. One of the things that when I took over that I was never really satisfied was how many cases are we prosecuting and what types of cases are
mm.
they? And we had like a snapshot of that, but it wasn't a great representation of what we're dealing with and what we're seeing. So this new program, I'm hoping, will be able to explain that and help us articulate what types of cases.
One of the reasons for that is you could have one case with multiple charges, and so it might be labeled in the system as its most serious offense, but then it has a less serious aggravated assault case. And so in terms of how that gets recorded in the system wasn't always as clear as it should be.
Okay.
Yeah, so you would see a number of domestic violence cases, but like that, we're definitely seeing a lot more than that, because you have a DUI, so that's the most serious offense, but there was some domestic violence going on like during that episode, and it doesn't count it. Does that
interesting.
Make sense?
So
so those are the things that we're trying to say. We don't want to miss that stuff. We're trying to track gun cases, so you have a drug offense, there's a gun charge as well.
Right.
Is that a drug case? Is that a gun case? The last program didn't address those things.
Okay.
And so those are the things that we want to track better.
Okay, so domestic violence is, we think, an increasing issue in the area?
It feels like it. We're dealing with it more often, and I know that law enforcement, they're responding to those types of calls. In fact, we had an officer involved shooting, and if you guys were involved in
just a few months ago.
On Veterans Day, actually, yeah. And that was a domestic violence call. We had somebody call in saying that they were a victim of abuse, and when they get there, they're going into a situation that's life or death.
Yeah.
You know? So these are serious cases as well, and you never know what you're getting into.
Right.
And so we're seeing a rise in those types of calls and those types of cases, protective orders. I feel like we're getting those more and more frequently, and violations of protective orders. And so these are things that we want to try and push back against and try to curb if we can.
Yeah. What are you seeing as far as drugs? Right here on the I-15 corridor, is it increasing? Is it decreasing? Is the type of drug changing?
I think we see the constant types of drugs. Methamphetamine is always going to be the most prevalent here in the county, but heroin, opioids are always a large part too. I will say that before I took over, I was the drug felony prosecutor. So my caseload was mostly drug offenses. I worked with the task force really closely. When I would prosecute those cases, if you got 2-3 pounds of meth in your car, I'd be like, holy cow, that's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big case. Last year, we had anything from 20 to 40 to 80 pounds of methamphetamine that they're moving on the highway.
Wow.
And also heroin. troopers. So that, the most that we've ever seen, and you talk to the troopers, you talk to the task force, that is unusual to see that.
Okay. Where is it coming from, one specific spot, or is it?
California a lot of times.
Okay.
And you can tie it to a lot of times it's the cartel.
Okay.
And getting it from Mexico, California, picking it up, taking it to anywhere from Iowa to Minnesota to Salt Lake.
Wow.
So, yeah, so these, a lot of times you learn where these destinations are going. A lot of marijuana, big loads of marijuana, and what they have is the THC oils and the vape cartridges.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that goes to Minnesota for some reason. But yeah.
That's odd.
What's going on there? But I would say it's increasing the amounts that we're seeing in,
okay.
in what we call pipeline cases.
Mm-hmm.
Just extremely large amounts.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What else is happening that we need to know about?
Well, I think everybody, just lock your doors in your cars because the vehicle burns. We see a spike in that, and probably as it gets warmer, we'll see a spike in that too. Or, with people out about, and especially now that the kids are all out of school because of the coronavirus.
Yeah.
Kids messing around, so make sure if you park outside, lock your doors. But I would say too that we live in a great community. We don't live in a place that you have to be paranoid, and that's what I love about Iron County.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I have friends or relatives that come from other places, they think we're naive and taking precautions.
Yeah.
But, it's important to do that, but we do still live in a safe and a wonderful place.
Absolutely. So one of the things that was on our list, talking about criminal justice and JRI. So what's happening with JRI? And before you go there, maybe just give a brief history. What is JRI and why are we even talking about it?
So JRI was, it's the Justice Reinvestment Initiative, and it came, 2015 is when it was passed and began to have effect. And a lot of it had some really great things. I think you want to focus and divert attention to low-level drug offenders and focus on the violent offenders and sex offenders. I think I'm definitely supportive of that, and I think law enforcement is as well. But I think what we have seen that I have concerns about, and I think a lot of people would have concerns about, is when you see the sentencing guidelines, the matrices, the recommendations for how long certain individuals should be on probation. That's concerning because it's not nonviolent individuals. We're talking about people who are committing violent felonies. We're talking about people who are committing sex offenses, and they're benefiting from JRI.
How are they benefiting? What's the mechanism that used to be in place that's not in place anymore?
Some of the new guidelines for probation lengths. That's one of the big ones. So we had a couple, we get every once in a while, we have somebody who's on probation, one individual for sexual offense against a teenager, and typically they're sentenced to 36 months probation if they're not sent to prison. This person was not sent to prison, they were sentenced to probation. 17 months into the probation, because of JRI, they say they've met the guidelines and they should be terminated early. And then we look at those very closely to say, hey, they complied with every term of probation, treatment, restitution, and we'll file objections if they haven't. But those are the type of things they're eligible for early termination from probation. So a sex offense, a felony sex offense. And
JRI is something that has come from the state. These are state guidelines that are sort of being imposed on the local counties and municipalities.
Yes. The other thing that I think we see that has bled into violent offenses as well, and JRI allows the Sentencing Commission to set guidelines. So if they look at your criminal history, they look at the level of offense, and they put it into a matrix, and it makes a recommendation for jail as a condition of probation, or if you exceed the amount of points because of your criminal history, because if you've been on probation before, been unsuccessful, they'll spit out a number. That has been reduced.
Mm-hmm.
So it's much, much harder to get prison or significant jail time, even for violent offenders.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I'll just throw out a scenario. It's a real scenario. Somebody who takes a gun, points it at their girlfriend, strangles her to the point where she can't breathe, is convicted of an aggravated assault, a felony. What would you, anybody have an idea of what the recommendation would be as far as a sentence from a matrix perspective?
I would want that person to go to jail.
For how long?
I would want that person, if if I get to be in charge of the world, I would want that person in jail for at least a year.
Okay. Yeah, a year or two sounds about right.
A year or two. The recommendation from the Matrix was 0 to 60 days weekends.
Wow.
So that they can serve their sentence.
With a midpoint of 30 is usually the midpoint becomes the recommendation.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so we argued for more, and we did get a little more, but it just feels like it's, I think we ended up getting 150 days.
Still feels inadequate.
Yeah.
And so we're arguing against this matrix a lot of times
on
these serious offenses. I mean, this is a violent offense. We have
right.
a gun involved. We have somebody who's strangled, can't
right.
breathe.
And what it feels like is that, you know, there's been this movement towards less emphasis on incarceration on nonviolent drug offenses. And that, like Chad said, it's bled over
mm-hmm.
into violent offenses, sexual offenses, DUIs, you know, these crimes that really have a direct and maybe more clear impact on community and societal safety. And the problem with that is, you know, that despite maybe certain studies that say that incarceration isn't valuable, we're setting a bar as a society. We're delivering a message as a society saying this is how seriously we take
mm-hmm.
these certain offenses and even really violent offenses.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that you're losing deterrent effect. You're essentially communicating to others that this isn't that big of a deal.
Right.
And,
I don't, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm a big fan of, you know, rehabilitation,
mm-hmm.
but I mean, that's not rehabilitation, that's just cutting loose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, well,
yeah.
don't do it again.
And I think that, you know, having consequences and then rehabilitation
right.
is
yeah.
an important combination. And unfortunately, what's happening is, you know, we're focusing on rehabilitation, which is good,
mm-hmm.
but if there's nothing hanging over your head and there's not consequences to begin with, then the person who we want to finish their rehabilitation is not going to be motivated.
And that's what I've heard from law enforcement is the really frustrating thing, is they're arresting, to your example, they're arresting this same guy who pointed a gun and choked his girlfriend over and over and over again, because the consequence of JRI has been there's no teeth in this. And so this person isn't rehabilitated, and he's not getting, in my opinion, enough jail time, and so there's nothing to stop him from doing that again.
Yeah.
Like you were just saying, there's not really a consequence for that behavior, and so if he just gets out with weekends, is he back with his girlfriend now?
No.
Tell me he's not back with his girlfriend.
This particular situation, no.
Okay.
She moved on.
Okay.
That's a good thing. But that does happen a lot.
I know.
That's another frustration.
Yeah.
But another thing to that same example, so if somebody commits a felony offense, they bail out. They commit another felony offense, sometimes they'll bail out again.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're back the third time. They have 3 pending felony cases that have not been resolved.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
So sometimes we get to the point where we do resolve them. They plead or they're convicted in each case. And when that goes into the matrix, it's really, you get 3 for the price of 1.
Oh,
because
okay.
they take the most serious offense. That's what computes the matrix score. And so, of course, we can argue, you know, Your Honor, I think you should take into account that there's 3 felony cases, there's 3 separate episodes here, but what we're dealing with is matrix. It's just 1 case. You're really 3 for the price of 1. And that's a frustrating thing
yeah.
for us. And
well,
it,
I think that should be
offensive.
Frustrating for the community, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's the solution? What's happening with this?
And I don't want to be one of these people that just rails against JRI, because I don't think that it's the boogeyman. But I do think that we need to check the pendulum, because
mm-hmm.
I think sometimes... And an effort to correct things that aren't working or that we think can improve on in the
mm-hmm.
criminal justice system, we will swing one way. I just want to push back and say, hey, we should not let it swing so far that we are going so far against accountability and forgetting about victims here.
Right.
I think we always, sometimes we forget that the criminal justice system, there is an element of it that's to punish offenders and to
mm-hmm.
Make victims whole.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another part of JRI that's frustrating is, people are eligible to, offenders are eligible to get off probation if they have not paid a dime in restitution.
Mm-hmm.
And they can
wow.
they can potentially be successful. and they terminate probation successfully.
And sometimes they're successful in getting a 402 reduction, meaning that the level of the offense is taken down subsequently.
That's
without having paid restitution.
No kidding.
We always argue against that, and we say, we don't think that they should benefit from that if they haven't paid the victim.
What's a typical restitution look like? Is it just a dollar amount? Do they have to do a certain amount of counseling? Or when you say restitution, what is that?
So restitution is usually a dollar amount.
Okay.
So you steal from Bullock Drug, there's a dollar amount associated with that. That's ordered to be paid back. And depending on the type of offense, that could be, we've had cases with some of the things that were alleged in the Bryanhead case were millions of dollars.
Right.
Anything from small amounts, $10, $15 from Bullock Drug to $200,000 because somebody's been embezzling from a business.
Okay. How about some of these criminal cases? Like your example, the boyfriend points a gun, chokes his girlfriend. What would restitution look like in a typical case like that?
Sometimes none.
Okay.
Because just maybe there wasn't a monetary loss. But
okay.
in a lot of times those cases, any type of counseling that they receive.
Okay.
If there was medical, like if somebody's beaten and they have to go to the hospital, the Office of Victims of Crime will pay for that.
Okay.
The services and the health care for that victim, and then they request restitution.
So then the perpetrator would have to essentially pay back the cost of whatever those services
right.
were. Okay.
And you asked about other terms. There's other standard terms that are often rolled in here in terms of getting mental health evaluations, substance use evaluations, following through with any aftercare or treatment, and any other terms that APMP sees fit, whether that's drug testing, whether that's certain courses that hopefully are helping somebody to, gain skills that make them more productive. And
mm-hmm.
So a lot of that is already baked in, but restitution is typically talking about dollar amount.
Yeah. So as far as kind of circling back to, if JRI is, there's some good pieces to it, but it seems like it's putting a real burden on the community. What's the solution? Someone had told me, I think it was in the last couple of years, this was actually from the governor's office. Is that, do we wait till there's a new governor? Is this a legislative process?
It's a legislative process, and I think, my new governor's going to have to sign off
mm-hmm.
on it. So I'm hoping that maybe this is an issue in the gubernatorial race,
mm-hmm.
That this will be something that comes up. But I think we need it needs tweaks. We need to make sure that it's not burdening communities, because
right.
a lot of times, rather than sentencing these people to prison, which normally they would be because they've, multiple felony cases, they're not abiding by probation. So a lot of times we're just sending them to the county jail for
right.
a year, terminating probation. And that cost, we're
uh-huh.
having to house them, feed them.
Yeah, then it's the county
yeah.
citizens that are footing
yeah.
the bill for that rather
right.
than the state.
Right. And a lot of
yeah.
times those folks will be thinking, probation is a privilege, so if you're just going to blow it off and commit new crimes, even if it's, nonviolent,
uh-huh.
at a certain point, you're gone. Go
right.
to prison and serve your time up there.
Yeah, and like we just discussed, that importance of having something hanging over your head to motivate you to complete your rehabilitation.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that would probably be my starting point in terms of recommendations is, currently we say, okay, we're going to send you to very minimal jail time. And they know that if they violate the terms of their probation, the likelihood of them serving any kind of serious jail time is minute.
Wow.
Keeping the emphasis on rehabilitation, but saying if you don't complete that rehabilitation, this is what you're looking at, and then following through, and that's an important part.
Yeah.
Following through with that, and letting other people know, like, look, we're serious about this. It's important for in terms of motivation, because it's a difficult thing for these people to go through rehabilitation and drug programs and all these things. And so when it does get tough, a lot of times it's easier to say, I'll just do my 10 to 20 days and
mm-hmm.
let's cut probation and cause it's just too hard.
If you lose the legal leverage, it makes it
right.
Yeah.
easier to just walk away and not finish the treatment. So if you have something hanging over your head, like Shane said,
you need to stick with the carrot.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Carrot. Exactly. Well said.
So, okay. Well, I hope that the next governor will take that up.
Yeah, no, I think so.
So we'll have
Senator Vickers on, maybe bring up JR and everything.
Yeah, no, he's been always open to talk about it.
And we've talked to him in the past.
Yeah, Trevor and I have talked to him, and that was not that long ago. No. Just some concerns with changes that were going to be proposed in the guidelines, and he's always open. He's been great to us.
Good, that's fabulous. So what else do we need to know about your office, what you guys are doing, anything that you want to let the community know that is going on with you?
Well, we talked about, you know, we have 5 attorneys in the office. We, you know, there's multiple courts that we're covering. We have Justice Court, and that's a Monday, Tuesday. We have District Court, Monday, Tuesday. Juvenile Court, Wednesday. Drug Court, and Mental Health Court. And then, of course, County Commission and the civil aspects.
Uh-huh.
So we, not that the community needs to know necessarily, but we're making a push to try and get another attorney staffed and funded for the office, because I think that it's been long overdue. I think it's been about 17, 18 years before we've had another attorney.
Oh, wow.
So
no kidding.
It's been
the 5. Population has grown.
Yeah,
just
a little bit. Yeah, that's another big thing is caseload per attorney, and making sure that that's feasible and yeah, so population. And as we expand services, that's a great thing. You know, expand mental health court, expand
right.
certain things, but it does have a pull on resources.
It all takes time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The ABA actually recommends for a prosecutor, if you carry a felony caseload, 150 cases is the ideal number. If you're a misdemeanor prosecutor, 400. We exceed that all across the table, including those who have administrative responsibilities.
Oh, gosh.
And
I'm
like, yeah, I have
wow.
well over 150 cases, which is fine. I love doing it.
Yeah.
But it is something that we want to address.
Absolutely. Well, and you don't want something to fall through the cracks just because there's so many things in the pipeline there.
Yeah, we're putting out fires. But the community should know that we have, I think, a wonderful law enforcement community.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes, I think, the Canyon Creek services and all the other partners that serve victims and things. I think we're blessed here.
Absolutely.
And
like you said, really great people.
Yeah.
Great people. And you're one of them. You're a rock star in the community.
Well,
Jesse.
You're very kind. You're very kind.
Now, I feel fortunate to be in the position that I am. I love coming to work every day.
Yeah.
And just thank you for the opportunity, I would say, to the people of Iron County.
Yeah. No, it's great. Shane, you have anything to wrap up?
No. Same. I really am grateful. So.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I know you guys are super busy, and we really, really appreciate taking time to come and communicate some of the stuff that our community needs to know about the county attorney's office. So,
anytime.
Attorney Chad Johnson and Chief Deputy over Criminal Division Shane Clay, thank you so much for coming.
Thank
we really,
you.
Really appreciate
great
it.
Great work. Yeah.
We're practicing social distancing, so we're not shaking hands right now.
Sorry,
yeah,
fist bump.
High five, fist bump.
Hey, it's actually only 50% as bad as a handshake. So.
Well, thanks for having us.
You bet. It's called Country Politics, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Color Country Politics, a production in cooperation with Utah Politico Hub and graciously sponsored by Century 21 Prestige Realty at 121 North Main Street, Cedar City. Special thanks to Amoeba Crew for use of their song Background Indie Rock, licensed under Creative Commons. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever fine podcasts are found. Also, check out our YouTube channel where we post video of our interviews. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and our website at www.colorcountrypolitics.com.